Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us on the line today is Ms. Jane Raffaele, who is the chairperson of Associated Media Publishing, who publish Cosmopolitan, Marie Claire, House and Leisure, Good Housekeeping, and Women on Wheels. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your CV reflects history and the beginning of arguably some of South Africa's most famous woman magazines. You were invited to join Naspers as a founding editor of the first English women's magazine in the company, Fair Lady, in 1965. You then went on to set up Jane Raffaele and Associates in 1983 with your husband, Michael Raffaele, and business partner, Volker Kunal, to launch Cosmopolitan magazine a year later in 1984. The wholly owned House and Leisure and several other international titles such as Marie Claire followed, and including the only edition of O, the Oprah magazine, outside the USA, which was hailed as the publishing coup of the decade in 2002. You know, many of the women today, I consider, have been shaped by the journey of their life that preceded. Can you please share with us some of the pivotal moments in your life growing up?
Well, my life began in the north of England in a war. And so my most vivid memories of childhood were the war, cold, and hunger. And in the north of England, fear of being bombed and invaded by the Germans was ever present. However young you were, you knew that the greatest fear of everyone around you was the Germans were coming. And when they came, if you were Jewish, they would kill you. And then, being so cold in winter, that our mother interleaved the blankets with newspaper and put coats on top of us to keep us warm. And for dinner, wiping the dripping from our father's chops with some bread. These are experiences that the smallest child will never forget. But they also provide the determination and drive to get up, up and away, to escape poverty, and to be in control of your own destiny and not the helpless pawn in someone else's war.
That is an incredibly vivid memory that you paint. And if I can ask, how did you manage to leave England to come through to South Africa, escaping that poverty?
Well, many years later, the real escape from poverty was when the war ended and a Labour government came in. And one of the reforms that they introduced was a 13-plus exam for every child in the country. And every child who passed the 13-plus exam, regardless of their background, went on to a high school if they were girls or to a grammar school if they were boys. And the implications of that was that if you passed all your exams at high school or grammar school, you would become qualified to go to university. And I'm sure that most of the people who are listening know what a transformative effect on a person's life and career and prospects going to university can have. It's a huge, huge issue here.
Having that ability levels the playing field.
Yes. I think it does more, perhaps, in some cases, because if you have an absolute hunger for what education can bring, it gives you more like a springboard. It's not a ladder that you're climbing up. It's something that you jump onto, and its force, you know, propels you higher, perhaps, than some of the other children. Your need is greater.
And I think your hunger, because I think the more you know, it increases your appetite to know even more.
Well, that came from my mother. She was the strongest influence in my life. And her longing for tertiary university education, something that the teachers at her school had offered to pay for, incidentally, was totally frustrated when her father refused on the grounds that he needed her to work in the family photographic studio to help support her four younger sisters. She never got over this. So for her, books and the free library system in the north of England became her education and consolation. And I had absolutely no choice. She was determined to fulfill herself through me. And when I took that examination that I mentioned to you earlier, I came 13th in our town. And I think she was a little disappointed that I didn't come first.
It's so interesting what you say about fulfilling parents' intent. And some people have a view that they think that people live through their children. But I think if you are being able to step your children up, to put them into a position of power, elevate them higher than you were, and as you go through the socialization process, children are actually quite ignorant and don't know that it's happening to them and can only be grateful in the years later after those effects have been realized.
Yes, it depends how clever the children are at listening to what the adults around them are saying. I think that children understand and know a great deal more from an earlier age than we actually realize. And even if they don't understand the complete meaning, they get the tone of something and they apply that tone to the context. They don't have to know the meaning of the word context to know what it is. And so it's in the air, they breathe it in. It has an untold influence.
And you mentioned that your mom had been a big influencer in your life growing up. What would you say has had the biggest impact on you to make you the person that you are today?
Well, let's not leave our father out of this, because he was a gorgeous, feckless Irish welder with a drink and a woman problem. But she loved him. And so did we, and he never laid a hand on us. In fact, he is probably the reason why I always got on so well with men. If your father thinks you're wonderful, it leads you to expect respect and help from other men too. That's very, very helpful. It gives you actually a sort of unnatural advantage in the gender war.
And you've also emphasized the importance of both genders, and you've emphasized the importance of ideally growing up in a nuclear household to reap the benefits of both role models, being a mom and a dad.
Yes, if you can have that, you are blessed. Many, many, many children don't have that.
And no, they don't. Turning towards your career, you were a female entrepreneur in the mid-60s in Africa. I think being a woman during that time was quite momentous, especially in the business world. It touches on sensitive points like culture, religion, and tradition. In your experience, do you think that women leaders, whether in business or politics, face different challenges to their male counterparts?
Well, you only have to look at the last election in the United States to see that it still happens today. In a country where women are supposed to have gained so much equality that the female candidate for president was widely expected to walk away with the election on the grounds of her sex, not in spite of it. And still, a self-confessed lecher and abuser of women on his third wife actually won the election.
And in the States, I was doing some research yesterday evening on the Interparliamentary Union. I'd probably do it once a month. The last time I did it, they were ranked 74th in the world in terms of women representation in Parliament. And this year, in January, the results indicate they're now ranked 104th in the world. And I always find it shocking how you've got so-called first world countries who've got such low representation of women in their governing structures. And yet, in comparison to Rwanda, which leads the way at number one in the world in terms of female representation. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Well, I can give you another statistic, which I heard this morning on television, CNN probably. Apparently, the largest group of voters in the States are the ones who don't vote. And though they didn't give a sex breakdown, I am pretty sure that the majority of the non-voters will be women. I would take a guess on that.
And it's almost giving up your entire right that the suffragette movement had pushed forwards for, but also giving up your right to democracy and your future.
But I think it also reflects that it isn't only men who are ambivalent about women getting power, but that some women at least must be equally ambivalent about that. And, I mean, her critics, male and female, have blamed her for standing by her man, the then president, who was caught having sex with an intern in the White House, for rumors about the contents of her emails, and for raising money from big business to run a successful fundraising campaign to fund her election campaign. All candidates do the latter, and many of these women who are blaming her must have had husbands who were unfaithful to them. I think that women's expectations of a woman potential leader are even greater than those of men.
And I wonder, in that you've just said women's expectations of a woman leader are greater than men, I wonder how much influence their social circumstances have in terms of shaping their view, and if some women are ready to have a woman leader, as opposed to the world that they've grown up in, the environment where leaders have traditionally been men.
Well, and here's some evidence as to why this is still happening. There's a new US study which shows that by the age of 6, some girls are already starting to associate cleverness with men. For the research, which involved 200 girls and 200 boys, all aged between 5 and 7, children were read a story about a really, really smart person in which no clues as to their gender were given. Afterwards, they were shown pictures of two men and two women and asked to guess which was the story's protagonist. The 5-year-olds, male and female, were more likely to nominate one of the adults of their own gender. But among the 6- and 7-year-olds, that parity disappeared. The girls were more likely than the boys, significantly, to identify cleverness with the opposite gender.
So we're already seeing gender bias creep in at a young age.
Yes. I would suggest that is because in the group dynamics that they observe around them, they will observe and hear men being more assertive, being more heard and listened to than women are. And you don't need to know the name of what that is to not recognize it. Particularly, you know, in small children, which are at the peak of their learning, you know, curve already. It's nothing that we didn't know, but now it's been proved. I think that for the world to change in the ways that you and I would like the world to change, people themselves have to change. They have to want to change. And I know from my own background that you will only change and you will only succeed if you yourself want to change. If you want to, for instance, when I was at school, I had a complete phobia about speaking in public. And so much so that though I became the head prefect, I never made an announcement. I never thanked any of the visiting speakers. My friends and, you know, fellow pupils, someone always stepped up to do that for me. And when I wanted, on graduation, to get a fellowship and to go to the States and carry on with my education, the one I won was a Rotary Foundation Fellowship, which was a total disaster. Because as a Rotary Fellow, you have to do a lot of speaking. Luckily, I was saved by the previous Rotary Fellow, and she gave me some good advice, which I'll put out into the ether now.
Please do.
She said, don't worry. When you get to the States and you have to speak, all you have to do is tell them what you like about America. I said, but what do I do when I come back here and I'm faced with this lot who had just heard me make the worst speech they'd ever heard in the whole of their lives? She says, oh, don't worry. Just tell them what you didn't like about America. Such good advice.
Knowing your audiences and, in effect, turning weaknesses into strengths, because I'm sure that since then you've done a lot of public speaking.
Yes. I not only lost the angst and the silence and the fear, I did learn, partially because of the Rotarians. I heard so many of them speaking. And it was really funny because even when they were terrible speakers, they had no compunction about standing up and droning on. So I learned what not to do. And that was a very useful education. I then went on to make many speeches. You know, as an editor, which is what I became, you have to be a public figure as well, or you had to be at that stage. And then you would find yourself opening everything, you know, from baby shows to whatever, and being asked to participate in a debate and be on radio and so on. So, you know, practice doesn't necessarily make perfect, but it makes you lose your fear.
Given what you've spoken about now in terms of education, the study in the States, which showed that there was clearly a gender-based bias with young girls thinking that men are more clever, what do you think schools in South Africa should do in terms of preparing young women and our children for challenges of gender issues and how to overcome them?
Well, first of all, it's the government that needs to go to school. Whichever government comes in at the next election, they need to go to school, and they need to go to school in Iceland. Iceland is the country in the world that has consistently come in, I think, fourth as the most evolved and most gender-equal country in the world. And it does incredibly well, you know, as a result, including, incidentally, in tourism, because people are fascinated in other countries by the fact that in Iceland, men are the leading proponents of gender equality. And that tells you the truth, because basically, there is something in men which makes them realize that there is not just safety, but success and power in numbers. And they will gang together to get it. And then the ones who gang together to put the strongest among them into the most powerful position will cling on to his coat.
And be pulled up.
And progress with him. Women need to be more systematic and successful in attracting followers and unashamed in going about it. And they must openly formulate plans to gain power and to hold on to it and to bring about lasting change as a result. It's a great mistake to think that just by being a sweet little silent person, somebody is going to propel you into a position where you're going to change the status quo. It's exactly the opposite. You have to organize that for yourself, and I don't think that women do it well enough or often enough.
I think those are very important words of advice. Today we're talking to Ms. Jane Rafaeli, who is the chairperson of Associated Media Publishing. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. We left the last segment with a wonderful comment where she said that women need to systematically and successfully attract followers to gain power and bring about lasting change. And with that point, Ms. Rafaeli, I'd like to go on to the next segment of the conversation. This program is all about gender equality, and one of the subjects that continuously comes up is that the working world was designed around what I would typically say are men's hours, where society is losing half of its best multitaskers from the workforce due to traditional expectations of women to reform their work timetables according to family needs. What's your perspective of this, and given that you have four children yourself, how did you manage your timetable?
Well, you know, excellent domestic help, which still exists in South Africa, is what got me where I am today. And I think it's the most underestimated benefit that women experience in this country. But, of course, it is more difficult and more expensive to find good au pairs who can drive and have cars. All of this could be resolved by the government. And if they engaged in this proactively and gave tax breaks to working mothers to cover this expense, if they don't do that, it will continue to disadvantage women with children and elderly dependents, because women are the natural caregivers. It will be very difficult to ask your husband to toilet and bath his elderly mother when you know that she would actually hate that herself. So women, it's not just children, it's roles, it's not just men and women, it's women and men sometimes. But these are the realities of women's lives. And a government like Iceland, which is prepared to acknowledge and perceive these problems and then do something about them, has got a workforce which is not interrupted and which is fully, fully active, and it has an excellent economy as a result. And I think women here should be attending election meetings in large numbers and telling all candidates and party leaders that this is what they need. It's not a very big ask. And they must tell them at the same time, in loud voices, that this is what would get their vote, no matter who put it into practice.
That's a sensible option, looking at having tax breaks for working moms, because, as you say, the woman is the natural caregiver, and that extends to not just about the children, but it is also to elderly family members to take care of them. Mm. Whilst we're talking about timetables and structures, what do you think the 21st century should do in terms of being able to accommodate women's multiple roles so that they can be mothers, they can have a career, that they're not just defined by one dimension?
Well, they must just give them the jobs and let them get on with it. And female talent is not a peculiarity. It is something that is there. Female ambition perhaps needs to be nurtured more, but the talent is evenly, you know, allocated by our maker. So I think basically they need to just drop the blinkers, you know, look at what's there, and continue to put more women who deserve it into leadership positions. Because they will then solve the problem, because they will look at other women completely and dispassionately, and they will appoint them into the positions that they will be best equipped for, and they will let them get on with it, and if they don't, they will sack them.
And I think what's unique about your environment is that it's probably 90% women in your company. So, in effect, you've kind of got this microcosm of women working for women and with women.
Yes, we do. And we've lost count of the number of babies that have been born to the women who work with us. I consider it normal. You know, maternity leave is not a problem. In fact, I was once addressing a conference at Edgar's, and most of the people who were there were men. And I told them that in the year that we were in at that time, we had had a record number of babies at Fair Lady, and our profits had never been higher, and that they actually couldn't believe it. This was some time ago, actually. And I don't really think that that is something we need to teach at school. There are other things, you know, that should be in the school curriculum. But somehow or other, we might put it into the male mind a bit more strongly.
Skills should be taught in the schoolroom, and culture should be up to society to remove gender-based barriers. I think that would help everyone in the long run.
Yes. But gender equality is not just about barriers and numbers. It's about changing everything in the society for the better. You know, if you can remove prejudice in one area, then you should be able to remove it in all areas. And we're living in a time when people are changing, and they are changing more and more freely. For instance, the whole transgender evolution. And we are hoping, incidentally, in our titles, to be part of a project to see that people who are albinos are acknowledged as being as beautiful as anyone else. And we want to see them put in the fashion shows along with the other models, and in the fashion shoots as well, and to have their particular problems acknowledged on the beauty pages. That, you know, the first way that you demonstrate unfairness to people is to make them invisible. And having said visibility, I think that it also places an onus on the person, whether she's a woman, whether she's a transgender person, whether she's an albino, to be brave enough to be able to say, yes, I will take that chance, I will be visible. For people who are actually killed for what they are, which happens in Africa, that takes a lot of bravery.
It does indeed, and also I would say bravery on the part of the media owners, because media has a strong responsibility in terms of shaping and informing public perception. And if you're able to feature different people, whether it's transgender or albinos, on the cover of your magazines, you're able to put a message out into society that this is normal, this is allowed, this is permitted. It removes some of that unconscious bias that they have in terms of acceptability.
Absolutely. And we have an even stronger platform than a magazine cover to work with at the same time, because we have social media. And here you tap into these huge audiences. And if they feel for something and they start spreading that image and that word, then you really are. In fact, I think social media is probably the thing that will propel all of the groups that we've been talking about, including women, into equality quicker than anyone else.
It's got exponential effects. As we're a gender-based program, what is your opinion in terms of the influence of media on views of gender?
Well, if I was to go back to the Fair Lady days, when I had not been here very long, and I had a tremendous disadvantage because I only spoke English. So all around me there were people who spoke other languages and who were communicating to each other in those other languages. And I couldn't eavesdrop. And there were no platforms at that time where the people I most wanted to know about, the women, could get onto in order to express their feelings so that I had a chance of hearing them. And one of the interesting things for me was that some of my assumptions had to fall away. And one of those assumptions was that all women would want to better themselves. And one of my most astonishing discoveries was that the best educated women in South Africa, that was the white women, who in many cases had gone to university, had not done anything with that education. You can imagine with my background how horrified I was.
Absolutely. And Did you investigate it?
Well, those were the women that I was talking to, because they were my generation. You know, they were all around me, and the Afrikaans ones called going to university mansoek. Seek a man. And so, I mean, I was open-mouthed in some occasions, you know. So then I get this amazing platform, which was called, of all things, Fair Lady. Worst title it could possibly have had. And I start speaking to the readers, and the readers fall on it because they've got plenty of free time, the white ones. And then luckily for me and the magazine, they all had lots of domestic help, and the domestic workers read their Madam's magazine. And so, without being in direct communication, I had the mixed audience that I felt was right, you know, and needed to be somehow achieved. And it was achieved through this peculiar statistic, the non-working women who didn't want to work, who then opened that door and those ideas to women who were working because they had absolutely no choice. And this gave us enormous numbers. And Fair Lady, though it was banned at least 4 times by the government at that time, managed to survive and thrive because of the extraordinary readership numbers that kept coming up in surveys, and the, you know, the strength of the readership was that it was reaching all women. It was reaching then went from the domestic workers back to their families, and there the women who were working as social workers, as teachers and as nurses, they came into that group of readers for Fair Lady. And it was a fantastic audience, and we could then go ahead and get away with any kind of murder we liked.
That's such an interesting dynamic. So you had the primary audience, who didn't make up the bulk of the audience, but their pass on readership to working women gave you greater access to more women who really needed the publication. I think that's a wonderful story.
I know. It's ironic, but it's very encouraging.
You've done and you've achieved many things in your life, and you've received numerous awards for professional and humanitarian achievements. Do you think that we as a country are in the right place, as you had imagined?
No. Not at all. Gender equality is not just about numbers. It's about changing everything in this society for the better. Just Google Iceland and see what they are doing. And imagine if Muzi Meimani, for instance, became the leader of this country and didn't bother to reinvent this wheel, but simply sent somebody off to Iceland to get the handbook. We would unleash such an absolute avalanche, you know, of talent and opportunity and effectiveness and results. Equal opportunity gives maximum results. It's as simple as that. And we don't have it.
So we need to reset the bar. We need to promote equality in all spheres, and that in effect is re-engineering society at multiple levels, whether that's social, economical, and political.
And I think we need to demand from women in this generation, in this time, in this place, that they must stand up for themselves. It is not going to be given to them. They have to go get it. And, you know, I discovered in my life, and as I said, I credit my father with a lot of this, that when a woman goes to men and says, this is what I want, and that's what I'm going to do with it, The answer, very often, is yes. But if she doesn't do that, she's never going to get it. You have to stand up for yourself before you expect somebody else to stand up for you.
Assertion is incredibly vital. That's assertion, confidence, yes, are all incredibly vital. We are unfortunately running out of time. Can I please ask you to close out the show with a few words of inspiration which you'd like to pass on to women in Africa that are listening to us today?
Well, I think I'm going to stay with self-confidence, which is, to me, if you want other people to have confidence in you and to give you those opportunities, you have to have confidence in yourself. And it's much more likely to get you where you want to be than pretending to be a shrinking violet. And when people perceive self-confidence, they also perceive decisiveness. They think that your gut feelings that are based on experience and an unerring aim for the best table in a restaurant, the best seat at a conference table, and enough to spot the most interesting person in a room and get his or her attention with your first words. This is self-confidence leads to confident behavior, and confident behavior leads to success. And I think that's why "You Had Me at Hello" is quoted so often as a favorite line in a film. And it was never about sex appeal, but it was always about power over yourself and the attention it commands.
Thank you very much. I think that's a fantastic message. It's been such a pleasure having you on the show today. Thanks for taking your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me and giving me the opportunity. And I hope that among the people who are listening, there are those that are powering up right now. We need them.
I think you've given them the inspiration. Moving forwards with confidence and self-assertion. You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, and we have been talking to Ms. Jane Rafaeli, who's the chairperson of Associated Media Publishing.